Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Ashley Rinsberg. Before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Check us out on Rockfin. This is where you get all our premium content, and you get all the amazing content from every creator on Rockfin. That includes their regular and premium content. And click the link in the description. You can get a free account and check out who is there and what they have to offer. Also, check out the amazing new podcast by the Forbidden Knowledge Network, such as Inception, Raised by Giants, Day Zero, Understanding Propaganda, Dawson Time, and of course Forbidden Knowledge News and Beyond Classified, and you can get them all in one place at our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. Finally, guys, we're living in extremely unsure times. An emergency food supply may be a good investment right now. Check out the experts in emergency preparedness, My Patriot Supply. Their nutritious, delicious food stays good in storage for up to 25 years, and now you can get up to $100 off a four-week supply of their food. Just click the link in the description and see what My Patriot Supply has to offer. Today I want to welcome Ashley Rinsberg. He's a novelist, essayist, and freelance journalist. He is author of The Gray Lady Winked, a work of nonfiction that takes a hard look at how the world's most powerful media outlet, the New York Times, alters history and edits reality to serve its own agenda. In 2010, he traveled to Nicaragua to investigate the disappearance and death of his best friend, an experience that inspired his forthcoming novel, He Falls Alone. He is also the host of the Burning Castle podcast, which focuses on individuals whose work brings meaning to people living in a world caught in chaos. Ashley, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you, Chris. How about you?
I am excellent. And I've been looking forward to today because we're going to talk about the corruption and downright deception that media outlets like the New York Times, which we'll be focusing on today, regularly practice. And not only in modern times where a lot of people are starting to see it, but throughout history and people didn't even realize. And it's very encouraging to see that people are waking up and realizing a lot of the corruption and deception that's going on from our media. But this is your first time on. I'd love to hear more about your background and what led you down this path less traveled.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a great way to put it. I live now in Israel, and I grew up in the U.S. and kind of had this hankering to explore, to seek, to find answers, to find questions sometimes. And when I was 22, 23 years old, after college, I had a pretty good job working in an NGO in San Francisco called the Internet Archive. You might be familiar. They save web pages. They save the entire internet. So if you want to search for something that was like from 10 years ago, you go to the Wayback Machine and put it in. It's right there. So I was helping them develop a internet bookmobile. And that took me to Egypt, all over the world, and came back to San Francisco, and I just wanted to keep moving. So I got a job as a deckhand on a boat in the Mediterranean, and that went from Italy to Greece, and then I kept on going to Israel. And soon after I got to Israel, I was just reading some history books about World War II, and came across this book by William Shirer, who's a great journalist from that era, an American journalist who worked in Europe and wrote a book of history called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich about Nazi Germany. And in that book, he kind of just mentions in a footnote that the New York Times on the eve of World War II reported that Poland invaded Germany. And that sort of stopped me in my tracks, where I was like, wait a second, Poland invaded Germany? That's counter to everything we know, all the fundamentals about World War II and the history there. And what happened and who is the aggressor? You know, of course, that just goes without saying that Hitler and the Nazis were trying to conquer Europe, and they actually did. And Poland was their first target, or one of the first targets, at least. So I started to research how the New York Times, this great institution of journalism, could have gotten the story so wrong. And I found something very shocking about the reporting on Germany, and we can go into that a bit later. But what I did is kept researching and kept looking how many major historical episodes they not only got wrong, but knowingly got wrong. They knew this stuff was going on. They did it anyway. most of the time they did it because it was in their best interests. And that's really what led to the book that I've just launched, which is called The Gray Lady Winked, How the New York Times is Misreporting Distortions and Fabrications Radically Alter History. And in addition to writing nonfiction, I write fiction, a bit of stuff for the screen, and I work as a journalist. Right now, I've been investigating lab leak and the almost 2-year long campaign by the mainstream media to discredit and cover up lab leak. And I've really been diving into that and trying to understand exactly what happened, why the media did this, and how they did it. So that's sort of the nuts and bolts about me.
Very cool. Thank you for that. Would you say, to start out with, that the New York Times and many mainstream media outlets that we won't mention are mainly government propaganda tools to shift public opinion and even attempt to manifest certain outcomes in reality and, you know, create culture, basically?
Yeah, you know, I think what's happening is that, like, you know, when we look at, like, China or North Korea and or Russia, you know, the government either outright owns the media or directly controls it or indirectly controls it. In the US, the history, you know, traditionally was that the media had sort of was in opposition to the government. There was a tension between the government, you know, at least if we go way back. And that's why the media was always trying to protect itself from government interference. When you talk about press freedoms, we mean freedom from the domestic government. But what's happened over the last, certainly the last 50 years, probably took longer than that, but let's say at least 50 years, was that media became more and more big business. It became owned increasingly by these big corporations, and they know that it's in their best interest to please the government. It sort of greases the wheels. It gets them access. It maybe even in certain cases, it gets them some sort of contract with the government for business that are connected to their parent companies. And they don't want to piss the government off. And what happens is that you have this sort of weird kind of coagulated mass of government, big business, and media, which is where we are today. And I think that's how it's working, is that these things are all kind of, they're working together in concert. They're working, if you'd like to borrow a word from corporate America, they're working in synergy with one another. And that's a very dangerous place to be, because the media is supposed to be what we call the fourth estate, the last check on the three branches of government, the fourth. And when the government and the media are working in such lockstep with one another so regularly, you really do have a problem. So I think that's the big thing people need to be aware of. And, you know, I think people are generally aware that there's a problem, but we need to start drilling down to understand the mechanisms. And I think that's sort of where it begins.
Yeah. And speaking of where things begin, I think it'd be a good place to start with what you came across about World War II and what the New York Times was actually getting wrong about it. It was along the lines of the Berlin bureau chief during World War II was known as a Nazi collaborator, and the catastrophic ways it played out in the paper's reporting. If you could go into some more details, I'd really like that.
Yeah, so like I said before, the first thing that really kicked off this whole thing for me, this bug of really trying to investigate the world's most influential news organization, was reading that the New York Times reported that Poland invaded Germany. And I was kind of like, what's going on here? And I started going back and looking at their coverage, and some of the early coverage of Adolf Hitler was, you know, casting him in this very favorable light, or at least a very neutral light, where he was already, you know, by the mid-1920s, known as a raving anti-Semitic lunatic. And they were sort of talking about him as a patriot, as an unselfish patriot. That's how the New York Times characterized him. And this was a American newspaper, not exactly, you know, at least on the surface, friendly to fascism. And then I started looking over the years, like what was going on with the Times and their Berlin bureau over the course of the 1930s. And what you see is that again and again and again, their reporting was very favorable to the Nazis. They called the Berlin Olympics, 1936, the Nazi Olympics. They described them as the greatest sporting event of all time. And they said that the only thing that they could fault about the German youth, meaning the Nazi youth of that era, was that the goose stepping that they were so famous for was really not conducive to athletic performance. That was an actual single piece of criticism from a 3,000 or 4,000 word article about the Berlin Games. They called the Munich Accords, which were, you know, the disastrous agreements that led Europe straight into war, that in much to Germany's favor, they called them a freshening breeze across a conference table. And by the eve of the war, they had been reporting this way for almost a decade, if not more. And my question was, how could that be? I mean, the New York Times was already by the 1930s a mainstream, if not the mainstream, American news organization. They had more influence, more power than any other news organization in the US at the time. And they're reporting in a way that was so favorable to the Nazis that the Nazis were actually reading these articles on their own broadcasts because they made them look so good. So what it turned out to be was that the Berlin bureau chief, the man who was really setting the news agenda on how they covered Nazi Germany, was a known Nazi collaborator. His name was Guido Indaris, and he was known by other American reporters to be very, very friendly toward the Nazis. And it was to such an extent that when the war was actually started, the Nazis rounded up all the American journalists in Germany, and they put them in this frozen chateau. And only one guy was able to stay in his luxury hotel in Berlin. That, of course, was Guido Indaris. And in an official Nazi memorandum, the reason cited was because of his proven friendliness towards Germany at the time. So this was brought to the attention of the New York Times' management and owners, and they actually threatened the whistleblower with a libel lawsuit, because they knew that this guy Guido Indaris brought home the bacon. Like, he brought the goods. He got the good scoops. He had the best access to Nazi brass, because the Nazis loved him, so they would give him interviews, they'd give him scoops and information. And the New York Times did not want to lose their number one spot in that reporting lineup. They wanted to be known as the best. They wanted to be known as the newspaper that got the most scoops. And they wanted that because it was a business, because that drove profits. And that was one of the most disastrous mistakes they made in their history. Probably there are a few others that actually compete with it, but that was easily one of the worst. But more importantly, that really established the pattern that I explore in the rest of The Gray Lady Winked, which is that the interests, financial or ideological, of the owning family of the New York Times got in the way of their stated duty, which is to gather the facts and bring the news to the American public.
Now, there seems to be a lot of falsehoods, even just about World War II in general, that are coming out as of late, the more that independent researchers look into this stuff. I'm wondering how much of, you know, what the New York Times was doing was, you know, you said that, you know, of course they knew that this guy was a sympathizer, but how much of the actual reporting during that wartime were they doing just as, you know, propaganda for either side? Because, you know, from what I've learned from many independent researchers is, you know, we had a lot of our hands in some dirt during World War II, kind of on both sides, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And to that point, there is an entire chapter in the Gray Lady Winked, tongue-tied about my own book, which is about how the New York Times was working hand-in-hand with the American War Department to cover up the fact that the nuclear weapons that were dropped on Japan produced radiation poisoning, radiation sickness. They did not want the American public to know this. They wanted the American public and the rest of the world to think that those bombs were just like any other conventional weapon, just kind of bigger. And in order to do that, the War Department turned to the most powerful and influential news organization in America, the New York Times, and namely to their brightest science reporter, a reporter named William Lawrence. And they made an agreement. They made a quid pro quo. And it was very simple. And that was, if you, the New York Times, carry this line for us that there's no such thing as radiation poisoning and people in Japan are not dying after the fact, they only died during the explosion, then we, the US government, will give you unprecedented access to this bomb program. And that's exactly what happened. Of all the people on the bombing armada to go bomb, to drop the second bomb, the bomb on Nagasaki. Only one of them was non-military, and that was William Lawrence, the New York Times and Science reporter. And that quid pro quo resulted in the New York Times actively covering up radiation poisoning in Japan, and it misled the American public, who from then on thought, okay, this bomb is no big deal, it's relatively safe. And what happened is that just 10 years later, a little bit more, when there was tests on hydrogen bomb testing on the Marshall Islands, people died of radiation poisoning. That's something that if there had been public awareness, if Congress had gotten involved to stop it, such atrocities would not have been committed. So absolutely, it definitely went both ways. And it's the same pattern, which it was in the New York Times' interest to twist the truth, to bend the truth, to cover it up, to do whatever they had to do, redact it, in order to satisfy and fulfill their own needs. And that, to me, is a massive, massive failure.
Do you think that the New York Times was one of the first media organizations to kind of start playing this dirty game and just be all about the business and not about the reporting and actual facts? And they were the ones to kind of start this trend? Or do you think it was kind of,
no,
they had other media?
No, I think it's media. You know, I think it's media in the nature of anything where money gets in the way. We all kind of have a sense that when power is involved and influence involved and money, that it just corrupts the process and it corrupts the system. But what I do think is that as the flagship of the American media, the New York Times had a greater responsibility because they had more power, they had more influence, more access than anybody else. And what they did over and over and over was abuse it. And part of the reason for that is that they weren't owned by some sort of, you know, benevolent foundation or even just a corporation. I mean, as evil as corporations often are, this is a single family. And when you look at dynasties, especially dynasties that persist over that length of time, we're talking at this point today, 120 years that the New York Times has been owned by this one family named the Ochs-Sulzbergers. And so much power is in the hands of so few people. Things don't just go wrong, they go really wrong. And that's exactly what we've seen with the New York Times. Like, you can find other cases among American media or any other media in the world where they've really done bad stuff or they've just failed. But in the New York Times, it's catastrophic. It's stuff like World War II, like falling victim to the Nazis' propaganda ploy, which was the one I mentioned earlier, that Poland invaded Germany. That was something the Nazis designed as propaganda to fool Western media. And with the New York Times, it worked spectacularly. But throughout the past century or more, and this is what the Gray Lady Winked chronicles, we see that these failures committed by the New York Times are not just sort of ho-hum, you know, like, oh, well, they could have done a better job. No, these were things that actually changed history. That was the magnitude. And I think that's still actually what we're seeing today with the New York Times, with some of the reporting recently on various things domestically and internationally, is that they're actually still changing history. And almost always it's for the worse when things go wrong, at least.
Right. So let's go over some of the specific examples that you cite in the book. Let's start with the Times Russia correspondent, Walter Duranty, and why it's a bigger scandal than most people realize.
Yeah, so Walter Duranty is sort of a famous or infamous name in the annals of journalism. He's considered like the arch villain of journalistic malfeasance. He was known for covering up the Ukraine famine. So Stalin had just been sort of recently installed into power as the head of the Soviet Union, which at that point was just little more than a decade, 15 years old at that point. And Stalin, in a very Stalinesque fashion, consolidates power by killing lots of people. In this case, a lot of Ukrainians, Ukrainian peasants. This is something that was known as the Ukraine famine, that, you know, estimates vary. They're sort of, the median estimate is around 5 million people were killed by Stalin. This was a deliberate famine, something he caused. They're up to 7 million people dead. This is the higher end of those estimates. And Walter Duranty covered it up. Walter Duranty wrote, not that there was only not evidence for such a thing, he wrote that it was not happening. And when he was confronted by other reporters and other reports that there was a famine, he actively denied those reporting. And this was because he was the New York Times' Russia man. That's what gave him the power to deny anybody else's reporting. He could do that because he had that kind of credibility and legitimacy as the New York Times' correspondent. What The Gray Lady Winked shows, my book shows, is that it wasn't Walter Duranty. The New York Times for 100 years has wanted to lay the blame on this one guy. But when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense. Reporters want more than anything in the world to get great scoops. That's like their reason for being. They just want to get big stories, stories that really will be part of history. And that is any ambitious journalist's greatest desire. And Walter Duranty was an ambitious journalist. He was a brilliant guy, trained at Oxford. He spoke six languages. He was really quite a prodigy. And this is the kind of guy who, number one, would have known, and in fact did know, witnessed with his own eyes that there was a famine, and B, he would have wanted to get that scoop. What it turns out, and what I show in the book, is that the New York Times wanted him to report that there was no famine and instructed him to do so. And they did that because they were part of a sort of this upper echelon of elite American business people and businesses that wanted to get access to that huge market of 150 million people that was rapidly industrializing. They wanted to continue to export to them. They wanted to even level up that level of trade to make money. And Walter Duranty, when it came time for the US to officially recognize the new Soviet Union or not, the New York Times was part of a group of businesses and business people pushing for that recognition so that trade could continue. And when it finally did happen in 1934, there was a gala event in New York City celebrating this. And one man out of something like over 1,000 people there, one man received a standing ovation. And that was Walter Duranty. And it was because everyone in that room understood that in order for the US to publicly recognize the USSR, there could not be such a thing as a famine. You're not going to recognize a government that just killed 5 million of its own people as legitimate. So they had to keep that quiet and they had to hush it up. And that's exactly what happened. And again, Walter Duranty has received the blame for it, rightly so, but the New York Times has managed to deflect that blame to the extent that when the Ukrainian American community started calling for that Pulitzer Prize, sorry, I should have mentioned, Walter Duranty won a Pulitzer for that reporting. Ukrainian Americans started calling for the Pulitzer Prize Committee to rescind the prize and for the New York Times to give it back willingly. And the New York Times actually hired a consultant, a professor of history, to determine what they should do. The professor unequivocally recommended that they return this ill-gotten prize, and they actually refused. And they refused because they said that to return this prize would be something like the Soviet habit of airbrushing history, which obviously was complete nonsense. They didn't want to give back their prize because they didn't want to open up a can of worms to look at what other New York Times Pulitzers were just as ill-gotten, just as really based in a lie, actually, to put it simply.
It never ceases to amaze and disgust me, the level of alteration of our history just so these people can make a buck and you know, get up on the regular people. It's amazing, and yeah. It's gotten seemingly even worse these days, but it's been going on for so long, and that's another thing that it amazes me that people don't see how long and to the level and extent that our history has been altered by these mainstream media outlets.
Yeah, they are. You know, I've started, the subtitle of my book is How the New York Times is Misreporting, Etc., Radically Alters History. But recently I've begun to add a little phrase to the end of that, which is that how they alter history and edit our reality, because that's really what's happening. Yeah. We are completely, our world around us is shaped by the media. It's shaped by these corporations that have a lot of vested interest in really getting us to think and behave the way they want us to, because it serves their interests. But I do think there's a real positive trend out there, which is independent journalism. journalists who are going out and doing their own thing, independent of any company. A lot of nonprofit journalism is springing up in the, you know, over the last 5 years or so. And then we have stuff like this where people are just having conversations with one another. It's peer to peer. And that is the best thing, because you know, we've never really had this. Like, we've never had such a thing where like someone like yourself can start a podcast that's asking questions and getting some answers. And people are tuned into it. They're listening. They're opening their ears and they're opening their eyes. And I think that's an incredibly positive trend.
Yeah, and this is something, like you said, we've seen recently. It's kind of blowing up amongst this kind of, truth movement that's happening across the planet, is people want to spread this information, and they're starting their own things to do it. And yeah, it's great. It's very encouraging to see this going on. Let's talk about some more, instances in history where they've pretty much altered it, about the overthrow of the Vietnamese government at a very critical time.
Yeah, so the New York Times, obviously, they had a man in Vietnam. His name was David Halberstam. He was a very young reporter, graduate of Harvard, brash, arrogant. Even according to his own friends, he was considered to be arrogant. And he really just took a real strong disliking to some of the top American military brass. And he began to believe that, rightly or wrongly, he began to believe not only that America should not be in Vietnam, but that it was his job to help force the country out of Vietnam. And specifically, and this is where it becomes really problematic, specifically to do so by sort of putting a wedge between the United States government and its only ally, or its main ally, at least, in Vietnam, which was the South Vietnamese government, which was not a perfect government. There were abuses, of course. It was not democratic in the way we think of in the US, but it was better than the alternative, or was the only alternative, at least. David Halberstam and his colleague, Neil Sheehan, who's another famous name in journalism, and who later became the New York Times correspondent in Vietnam, thought that they would try to bring some change there. And what they did was start creating a false narrative about what the South Vietnamese government was doing to its own people. Part of that was really trying to create this picture of real gross abuse of, and including massacre of Buddhist monks in Vietnam. And they went so far as, in one instance, to report on the death of a massacre of 33 Buddhist monks by the South Vietnamese government. And when the UN came a month later or so to investigate this massacre, they found all 33 of those monks alive. There had never been a massacre. There had never even been a murder. It was really something that was completely made up. And the reason was because one of their most valuable sources for David Halberstam, Neil Sheehan, and the New York Times was a North Vietnamese communist spy. He was feeding them misinformation and disinformation, basically propaganda, and they were using it to advance their own interest, which was to create this division between the US government and the South Vietnamese government. And it came to a head when the head of the South Vietnamese government, a man named Diem, was assassinated. And this was something, it's a very murky history of the New York Times involvement in Diem's assassination. But it's something that they wanted to see, and they did see it. And when President Kennedy heard about this, he wept. He was more upset than his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, had ever seen him. And part of the reason for that was because he had been planning a very early pullout from the war. He wanted to get troops out in the early and mid-1960s, and that plan depended on there being a stable South Vietnamese government. And when Diem was assassinated, that put his plan into the trash can. And it took something like another, almost close to a decade of fighting of Americans in Vietnam before they could finally get out. It really was a catastrophe and a tragedy.
Man, it's completely disgusting how, you know, not only our own government, but the media and these corporations in charge have caused just as much bloodshed for the American people and abroad and people abroad as some of the wars that we fought in. They've propagated so much violence and misery across the world. I'm so glad that, you know, a lot of this information and people like yourself are bringing this to the forefront right now. It's really important for people to hear.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's something, you know, we all need to be aware of. And I also think it's something that we need to be, try to be nuanced about as much as we can be, you know, because on the one hand, you have the owners of these companies, these media companies or media corporations, and they are the ones who are advancing their own interests to the detriment of everything else. And of course, there are exceptions. We can't tar them with all the same feather. But what I do think is that there are plenty of excellent, excellent reporters out there, including in what we describe as the mainstream media. And they are doing their job, they're doing their best, they are diligent, they sometimes are often putting themselves in harm's way. So, you know, it's almost like we've got the little guys out there, like just kind of pounding pavement, trying to get the story. And then we got the bosses of these big companies. And we need to make a distinction so we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Because what these journalists do is really valuable. They're really trying to gather the facts most of the time. We see a lot of the bad apples, and there are a lot of bad apples out there today. We're seeing it more and more thanks to social media. Yeah. But I do think we still need to be cognizant that journalism is a great thing. It's one of the, I think it, for me, in my mind, it's a pillar of democracy and something that we need to say, all right, let's not just tear it down, but let's also continue to build it up.
Yes, exactly. Very well said. Now, I want to get to a couple of more examples of the Times manipulation throughout history, and then I want to get into some of the modern examples of what the New York Times is doing and your thoughts of what's happening today. Let's talk a little bit about the 1619 Project. What was this?
That's something that is still unfolding as we speak. That was something that's a project the New York Times launched last year, 2020. And it was really designed, in its own words, to reframe American history from being rooted in liberties, the story we sort of all know and tell, to exactly the opposite, which is to say that America was born out of and rooted in slavery. That what we live in today, Americans who live there today, is sort of at least an echo of this slave society, if not an outright perpetuation of a slaveocracy. And the reason they called it the 1619 Project was because 1619 is the year that the first slaves are thought to have arrived in the colonies before the Declaration of Independence by the US. So they're trying to shift the birth of the United States of America from 1776 to 1619. And the 1619 Project was a full magazine issue by the New York Times, a Sunday magazine, devoted to this one topic, something I've never seen them do before. I think that's probably the first time they've ever done it. And it's exploring or really advocating for the idea that all institutions, aspects, all parts of American culture are connected to slavery. Everything from traffic jams in Atlanta to America's healthcare system to America's love for eating sugary treats is all about slavery, 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 slavery. And they are succeeding in that idea, and they're doing it partly by putting that into the American education system. They're teaching kids that their history is one of slavery, and their present and their future is one of slavery too. That the white children of Americans who are not part of a Black history are essentially part of this slave society. And that very much fits into what we've heard a lot about critical race theory and yes, about this push towards declaring whiteness to be this sort of evil in the world that no one can do anything about. No matter how hard you try, you're going to be evil if you're white. So,
right.
You know, it really dovetails into that.
I want to get your thoughts on these division tactics that are being used by, you know, not only the New York Times, but most mainstream media outlets. It seems like, you know, Project Mockingbird is still, of course, alive and well amongst all these media outlets, but they are all pushing these, you know, division tactics that basically white people are evil and, you know, we need to basically be put in internment camps and we need to have some kind of revolution against us or something like that. You know, we're pushing this division against races that we've not seen for this level of in a long time. I'd like to get your thoughts on what's behind this.
You know, I think for among rank and file journalists, there are a lot who truly believe that to be true. They've sort of adopted the ideology from elite American universities that teaches this stuff. They've been indoctrinated by it, and they really are now partisans for it. But I think on a corporate level, it goes back to the same thing, which is money. What do I mean by that? The New York Times knows that its audience, which used to be sort of like middle of the road liberals, is now becoming sort of hard left progressives. They're younger and they want to hear about this stuff. And that goes to the extent that the New York Times had made the 1619 a centerpiece of its long-term marketing plan. And they were very open about that. They used 1619 to market because it was attractive to this audience that they want to serve. And that's part of the broken model of media today, which is that, let's say the New York Times has 100 million unique visitors to its website. Of all the people reading the New York Times on a daily or weekly basis, only about 2% are really paying them for subscription. The internet broke the advertising model in media, and they are left relying on subscribers, which means their base is going to be polarized by definition. And this is something that the news media has been criticizing big tech for. We've heard a lot about Facebook's algorithms trying to drive polarization because it's really good for clicks. The media has done the exact same thing. They're doing the exact same thing, and possibly to even worse effect. So this is really about the money. This is really about them serving their audience, serving their base like any political party would, and serving them with content that is really going to rile them up, get them to take action, get them to change their minds, and get them to change their behavior like any brand does. And I think that's where we see a lot of this stuff in media, the division, because it pays. It's good for business.
Something else new we've been seeing, I think it was like around 2017, 18. I remember actually the day they canceled the Alex Jones show and took him out of all the platforms and stuff, I noticed that my show had the views started getting cut in half on like these big platforms like YouTube and every Facebook and stuff that I was on, and it started getting less every day after that incident with Alex Jones, and then censorship everywhere across the internet, across YouTube, channels are just getting deleted, boom boom, everything is like happening really quickly, the censorship starts ramping up out of nowhere. Did you notice this, and I was wondering what your thoughts about why the timing and what was behind the rapid censorship of all these platforms during this time period? And it was before COVID too. It was before the whole COVID thing.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a couple things. Number one, and I hate to sort of beat this drum over and over, but really it is money, because these big companies, they're dependent on major brands, Procter's and Gamble's, Deloitte's, companies that are paying them huge amounts of money to run ad campaigns. And those companies don't want to see a certain kind of criticism of their core ideologies, which today we're seeing is about the woke ideology, which is about a certain view of race, all the kind of stuff that they've taken as orthodoxies. They don't want the protesters out inside of their own buildings in their headquarters. And it's easier for them to not be associated with that stuff and to have YouTube just take it down. They have that kind of leverage. When you're paying millions or tens of millions of dollars a year as an advertiser to this company, and there's not just one of you, but it's you and 100 corporations just like you, that's real significant money. And that really affects the share prices. So they want that kind of content off the air. It's disruptive to them, to their businesses, to their ideologies. I think that's one piece of it. But I think another piece of it is control. I think it's power. I think these companies have become so powerful that they do what any organization with power does, which is get more power. And by controlling who gets to talk and who doesn't get to talk and what they all get to say, they have given themselves a huge lever for power that they can use at will. There's no check on that power. No one could tell them any different. So of course they're going to use that lever, and of course they want to make that lever longer and longer because it gives them more and more power. And I think between money and power, that's the result that we have today with companies like YouTube and Google, which famously started out with its slogan being "Don't be evil." And you know, they've come a long way since that, and they've become a much bigger company, not coincidentally.
Yes. Yeah. It's very interesting to see what's happening right now. We're definitely under attack. You know, independent media, independent journalists, content creators. More of my friends are off the air every day because, you know, their platforms are getting deleted if they say the wrong thing. But we're also seeing the fear backlash of that occurring to where people are self-censoring now and they're getting off the big platform and they're not talking about this stuff anymore out of, you know, afraid of being censored or even worse, you know, some people being disappeared or suicided even. You know, it could come to that point for people that are really wanting to get to the facts and the truth about things. It's becoming a little dangerous, and it's, you know, at the least you could lose your career over it. So live in very important times, and I think that now more than ever people doing this need to do it more and come out more and fight against it more, and or we'll lose, you know.
100%. But I think that it's, you know, I understand, I've seen it, like you, I've seen a lot of people around me, including myself. My book was banned from advertising on Facebook very early on when my sales were like doing great. My book was throttled on Amazon mysteriously. No one could explain it. And, you know, I've seen it happen to other people around me. My response to it is to say, build your own platform. Or get on platforms that are sort of structurally neutral, like if you know about ghost.io or Locals or any platform that is going to keep their hands off. You're going to have to build your audience from scratch. You're going to have to figure out a new approach. The models are going to be different, but the possibilities are out there. And I think what people do need to do is build those audiences for themselves and keep talking, keep raising their voices, keep speaking out. And take that risk. And, you know, in the famous words of Nietzsche, live dangerously. It is dangerous, but live dangerously, because to live in fear and to live in that state of what's going to happen if I talk is almost worse than whatever those consequences might be.
Definitely. Now, you mentioned that you're working on research on the whole lab leak thing, and you'll be writing a book about that. Is that right?
Right now, I'm just reporting
on it
as I find. Yeah, I'm reporting new information and trying to connect the dots.
Well, I'd like to understand. I'd like to get your thoughts on the whole situation from the onset in 2020, whenever the whole COVID thing happened, especially when it comes to the reporting of New York Times and organizations like this. When did you start seeing shenanigans occurring, basically?
That's a great question, because that's a really important piece of this, is that, you know, what actually happened, how this virus actually emerged, I personally don't know. What I do know is that the original explanation propagated by the media, which is came from the so-called wet market, the seafood market in Wuhan, is not true. There is now scientific consensus that that's not the case. The alternate theory, which is that it came from the lab that studies coronaviruses that's in the same city, Wuhan, was for a year and a half discredited by the media. They called it conspiracy theory. They called it a fringe theory. They called it racist, and they called it xenophobic. And they started doing that in February, and in some cases, even January of 2020. And we have to remember, we didn't really even know there was a pandemic on our hands until around February. It wasn't even very clear. I don't think travel was from China was even closed until March, possibly even a little later. It was around then. So before anyone knew anything, the media had already decided that the notion this virus could have escaped the lab in the same city where it emerged, where they study the same kinds of viruses, discredited that as a conspiracy, as a racist conspiracy theory, is really alarming. And that again leads me to the question of why. Why would they do that? And when you go back and start looking at the timelines, you see that Chinese propaganda organs like China Daily were saying the exact same things, using the same words in some cases to discredit lab leak. And they were doing it weeks before the American media outlets were doing the same thing. At the same time, these Chinese propaganda outlets like China Daily were paying advertising money to American media, to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, to the Wall Street Journal. And you're saying to yourself, hold on a second, these outlets, China Daily and other Chinese propaganda outlets, state-owned, are paying all this money to these media companies. They're putting out messaging about this lab leak theory, and these American outlets are repeating those messages weeks later. What the hell is going on here? So is there a direct connection? Is there a smoking gun? I don't have one, but I know that that is a disturbing pattern. One where you'd say that these American outlets that are really trying to prove their independence from outside influence should have stopped that money from flowing at very least, but they didn't. The money was still flowing. They were still reporting on lab leak. Still today, some of them are reporting on lab leak the same way, trying to really push the notion that it's impossible, that it's a conspiracy theory, that it's a fringe theory, even though we now have more and more evidence and more scientific backing for the notion that it's at least possible. So I'm still kind of following that trail and trying to understand, number one, how did the media do this? Exactly. What was the mechanisms? Like, how did it work? What did they say? What kind of messaging did they use to convince us all that lab leak was a racist conspiracy theory? And how did they do it so fast? And then I also want to understand, why did they do it? What caused them? And I think, again, we go back to the notion that when you look at, take the Washington Post as an example, very early on calling lab leak a conspiracy theory, it is owned by Jeff Bezos, who, as we know, owns another company called Amazon. And at least 50% of Amazon's top 10,000 retailers, merchants, are based in China. That is a huge amount of leverage. That is a huge amount of money that flows into Amazon's coffers. So again, I'm not saying there's a direct connection there, but what we do know is that there is some awareness of the importance of Chinese money to all of these corporations. And all of these corporations behaved in a way that is very suspicious and invites a lot of criticism and questioning. And I think we all need to be looking into this issue very carefully, because in my opinion, it is not only the most important news story of our generation, how the virus emerged, but it's also what's shaping up to be the greatest journalistic scandal of this generation as well.
Yeah. Now, I kind of jokingly mentioned Project Mockingbird earlier, but it's very apparently real. What level of coordination do you think these media outlets actually have when it comes to, you know, making sure their story stays straight and kind of aligns among all these outlets?
I think it's to some extent, it's groupthink. That was a term that emerged after the Iraq War, during the Iraq War, where a lot of the American media was saying there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and the Bush administration ran with that, or possibly gave it to them and then ran with it as a justification for the war. And it turns out there weren't WMDs, as we all know. And one of the terms that emerged was groupthink. They were all kind of thinking alike. We sort of see these big journalistic figures from afar and be like, oh, that's the New York Times, that's the Washington Post, that's whoever else. What we forget is that these people all live in the same towns. They have the same friends. They went to the same colleges. They have the same assumptions about the world, and they start to think alike. And I think that's a big part of it. And I think the other part of it is that they also form a daisy chain of information. One part of this was, as an example, the Chinese ambassador went on, I think it was CBS News, and to talk about, in part, lab leak, and calling it all the usual names, racist, xenophobic, etc. That was then taken by the next outlet, which was Politico. And from Politico, I went to Business Insider. And from Business Insider, I went to 100 other news outlets. So you've got this sort of a funnel of information that connects all these media outlets to one another, because they're using each other's reporting as corroboration, or at least even as evidence, rather than going out to do their own reporting. And it, again, that's a big problem, because what we have is something like the situation we've experienced with LabLeak, where they've all reported the same thing. It's all been completely wrong. And there was no one even kind of poking their head up to say, you know, we need to explore the alternative here and not just assume that this is the absolute truth.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you this, since I covered the strange and unusual topics. I want to get your thoughts behind the 2017 UFO articles that the Times released, and then everything since then that they've been kind of alluding that either we're not alone or they don't know what these things are, because it's the New York Times and I don't trust the media, and you know, I cover this stuff a lot, so I'm very interested in why they would be reporting on this all of a sudden. What are your thoughts?
I think that's, you know, I just did an interview with Michael Shermer, who's the founder of Skeptic magazine, and this is a very important issue for him, because he's a scientist or science-minded individual, and he really looks at the UFO phenomenon as essentially fake news, just a really sort of classic form of fake news, where it's great reporting, it's makes, you know, really drives people to pick up that newspaper, buy the newspaper. But when you look at how they position these stories, they're using a lot of loose language. So Michael has pointed out that when they talk about a video showing an unidentified object, and they say that in the headline that the video is real. And what Michael points out is that there's a difference between the video itself being authentic and what we believe to be seeing on the video to be authentic. So you can have a video that was actually taken by a Navy jet showing something. And that's not to say that what's in that video is necessarily being flown by an alien. Right. Or that it's anything that's flying at all. It could be any number of things, we just don't know. But what the Times has done with these headlines is grab people and make them say that the New York Times is saying that UFOs are real. Let's get into this article, let's share it, let's pass it around. And again, that's what we call clickbait. It's kind of a highbrow form of clickbait in this case. I'm not taking a position here about life beyond this planet.
Right,
I have
right.
no idea. I'd love to explore the idea. I think it's fascinating. And I, you know, in a way, maybe there is, I hope there is, I don't know, maybe there's not. But the Times and other media have basically adopted these clickbaity techniques. And I think they've sort of poisoned the well a bit, maybe, you know, poisoned an already poisoned well, but, you know, another drop or two.
It's definitely an interesting time when they decide to, you know, come up with all this UFO stuff. It's like they're trying to go off a script of the Book of Revelations or something sometimes, man. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
They 100% are. If anyone out there reads the Drudge Report, you know, the great news aggregator from the 1990s, that's still really great today. You see a lot of that stuff. You see a lot of the apocalypse stuff. A lot of the world sort of collapsing and crumbling before our eyes. And it's not to say that we're living in rosy times. It's not exactly, you know, all peaches around here.
Right.
But it's also not the apocalypse. But the apocalypse is good news. It's good. You know, the famous saying in the news that if it bleeds, it leads. And that's exactly what it is. Like, they're still just trying to drive clicks and views and shares and downloads, because that's good for business.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, it makes too much sense when you put it that way. I myself, you know, in my personal circle, of course, I hang around with people who already know that the New York Times is reporting BS and misleading people. But do you see more people than usual that are not watching the news anymore, that have come around to, yeah, this is a bunch of BS and this is clickbait and I shouldn't watch this because this isn't even reporting real news? You know, more people coming out with that point of view, and do you see a fall of this kind of mainstream media, this false reporting, and all the things that go along with what has taken over our media these days?
Definitely, 100%. I absolutely see people turning away from them. I see a good friend of mine was a New York Times staffer after college. Her father was a well-known Irish journalist. Her name was Jenny Holland. And she's pretty open about the fact that she won't even look at the New York Times. She used to think of it as like, you know, the absolute ideal of journalism. She had that really sort of rose-tinted view of it when she was younger. And today she won't even open the newspaper. And I hear that from lots of people. I hear it from people all the time in the New York Times case who were lifelong New York Times readers until today. And now they just can't actually stomach it. And that's the case, I think, across the board. People are getting fed up. If you look at CNN's ratings, they've had seen at least historic drops in their audience and their viewership. And people are turning their backs. They 100% are. So I think that that is something that's happening. And I also think that there will be a fall. There is already a fall of the mainstream media. I mean, if you look at their revenue numbers, if you look at their size of the newsrooms, if you look at the number of newspapers out there, they have lost the lion's share of their audience and they're not getting it back. I think at some point they thought they would get it back after it was disrupted by the internet, but they're not. And I think that's the scary thing for them. There's sort of a new reality for mainstream American news because people simply have other options, something they never had before. So they're turning away, they're finding other stuff, they're finding other sources, they're finding other formats. And again, I think that's awesome. I think that's a great thing.
It is. And Ashley, man, I want to thank you for the work you've done and for coming on the show and sharing this with people. It's such important information. Before you head out, I'd love for you to tell us about where the best way that people can find out more information about yourself, your books, and the Burning Castle podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. But check out the book at thegraylady.com. And gray is with an A, not an E. And that will give you sort of the whole rundown about the book. It'll lead you to the Amazon page. The Burning Castle podcast is something that I started a little while ago. I'm getting it back on track now that the book has been launched. And that's really about looking at people who are creators and using their creativity to try to sort of mend or fix a world that is in flames. They're, you know, you got these people who are out there who are sort of pouring oil on the flames. And I think we all know who those are, people who are just kind of indifferent. But then you've got a sort of silent few, or maybe not silent, maybe an outspoken few, who are saying, I'm going to do something about it in my own little way, through creativity, through creative thinking, whether that's in business or athletics or arts or literature, whatever else it might be. But they're engaging their creativity to try to put out those flames and build something different, build something that's new and that is more sustainable for the world we live in today.
Excellent. Yes, I'll have links to all your website and information in the description. Ashley, I want to thank you so much again for coming on today. That was fantastic information. And I'd definitely love to talk to you again in the future.
I would too. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, have an excellent evening. And until next time, have a great night, and we will talk to you again tomorrow.